Yes, unfortunately, change for the worse. I think the Israel is at a crossroad, but it has already made its decision which way it is going from this junction. It was in a junction where it had to decide finally whether it wants to be a democracy or to be a racist and apartheid state, given the realities on the ground. I think Israel in 2014 made a decision that it prefers to be a racist apartheid state and not a democracy, and it still hopes that the United States would license this decision and provide it with the immunity to continue with the necessary implication of such a policy vis-a-vis the Palestinians, wherever they are.
What do you think the U.S. should do?
Well, the U.S. should apply the basic definitions of democracy to Israel and recognize that it is giving, it's providing an unconditional support for a regime that systematically abuses the human rights and the civil rights of anyone who is not a Jew between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. If America wants clearly to support such regimes, it had done it in the past, that's okay. But if it feels that it wants to send a different message to the Middle East, that it really has a different
agenda. We have 2 seconds.
Human rights and civil rights in Palestine.
We have to leave it there. Professor Ilan Pappe, thank you for joining us. I'm Mimi Goodman. Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is more talk radio with our hosts Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. Today's guest is professor and writer Jennifer Earle, co-author of the book Digitally Enabled Social Change, about how the internet affects social change and political protest.
From expulsion to arrest, from the classroom to the cell block. This is the school to prison pipeline in Oregon. We'll talk to Mark McKechnie, an advocate for youth and the young men currently incarcerated at McLaren. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on July 28th at 6:30 p.m.
The news is bad. Untold scores of traumatized children fleeing the violence engulfing their homes. The U.S. government and your tax dollars fueling the flames. Am I talking about Honduras, Gaza, Syria, or Iraq? No, I'm talking about our longest-running war, our 9/11 bomb 'em back to the Stone Ages war, Afghanistan. A human crisis of nearly incomprehensible proportions continues to unfold while other crises grab the headlines. Join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, for Wednesday Talk Radio. Call in and talk with guest Professor Zahair Wahab, just back from Kabul. Ask your questions and share your point of view on America's longest war. That's Wednesday Talk Radio with guest Professor Zahair Wahab, right here on KBOO Community Radio.
I am ready. Good morning.
Good morning.
Today is Monday, July 28, and you are listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey, and you're listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, in the Willamette Valley, 104.3, and on the web, KBOO.FM.
Listening to that last report from Democracy Now, and it was conversation about what's going on in Gaza, I was reminded a couple years ago when there was this movement happening throughout North Africa and the Arab world, where there was uprisings against dictatorships. And a lot of it was organized via the web or via tweets. And also we experienced that in this nation a few years ago with Occupy movements. And it contrasted, I think, very clearly with traditional organizing. I'm also reminded of, you know, 50 years ago, there was this March on Washington. And what was amazing about that was that it was able to organize 250,000 people to gather in a matter of weeks without the technology that we are used to now. But things have changed, and our guest, Jennifer Earle, is the co-author with Katrina Kimport of a very important book entitled Digitally Enabled Social Change. And we are pleased to have her here this morning. She was scheduled a few weeks ago, but she was ill.
So we're glad to have you here, and hope you're feeling better.
Thanks, I am, and thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this.
Well, first and foremost, tell us a little bit about yourself and what inspired you to write this book.
Sure. I started originally studying social movements 15, 17 years ago. And at that time, I was principally interested in a different topic, which is how social movements are repressed by state and private actors, so how state and private actors try to control and constrain protest. And as I was working, and I still do work in that area, but as I was working in that area in 2000, we had an interesting situation come up in the election where we had the development of what was called strategic voting. And so if you remember back to that election, people felt torn about whether or not they should vote for Nader versus Gore. And it was a real struggle for some people. And a technological solution was developed that allowed people to exchange votes across state lines so that if you were in a safe state, so a state that was definitely going to go Bush or Gore, you could agree to vote for Nader because it wouldn't affect the overall vote totals in that state. But if you lived in a toss-up state and might have otherwise voted for Nader, you could agree to vote for Gore and get someone else to vote for Nader in one of those safe states. And that was called strategic voting. And I and a colleague of mine, Alan Shishman, started studying that when it began and studied it through the conclusion of the election. And we were interested, I mean, this was a time where literally Google was still something that people were sometimes using and sometimes not using. So it was fairly early days of internet penetration. The findings we found were really, quite frankly, quite surprising. So we found that actually about half of the activists that were involved in those efforts didn't have the traditional kinds of biographies that one expects movement activists to have. So they hadn't had strong political participation before. When I asked them in interviews about their level of political experience, they would talk about having read the newspaper, for instance. But these weren't folks who, you know, were sort of tried and true and come up through the ranks, as we usually expect with social movement leaders. Instead, one of the most common features that those individuals shared in their biography was a computer science degree or some significant computer experience. And what we found in that early research was that instead of bringing the kinds of protest heuristics or schemas for action that you would bring, or routines for action that you would bring if you had sort of come up through the ranks in social movements, you brought the kinds of schemas for action that you would bring if you worked in a technology firm. And so that really radically changed how these individuals acted and how they organized.
So let me stop you right there, please.
Sure,
and have
sure.
you explain what you mean by a different set of schemas, a different set of thought processes or strategies? If for some people who are not familiar with computer organizing, they may not know how, or rather computer programming, the whole computer world, how much that has changed how we live and how we organize and how we think.
Sure, that's a great question. So, for instance, if you were to start a social movement and you had been brought up in social movements and had, you know, kind of come up through the ranks, one of the first things that would occur to you is that you need to create an organization. So in order to get the number of people you'll need to be involved to make that effort successful, one of the very first things you have to work for is creating an organization. Now, in the engineering world, you can accomplish a lot of things on your own. And so one of the first things that occurs to people in the engineering world isn't necessarily making an organization. It may be trying to make a website on your own. And so for the few individuals who were involved in strategic voting who did come up through an activist background, they did what we would expect as movement scholars for them to do. They started off by trying to assemble an organization and assemble a larger team of people to work on that. The people who really had come up in the computer world and so were used to just trying things on their own and seeing how it worked and then fussing with it a little bit and maybe getting one or two friends involved, that's exactly what they did. So the idea of starting an organization wasn't even on their agenda. The idea was, well, I have this idea. Let me just program this website and see if it works, and we'll go from there. And so you saw radically different size teams involved in those efforts. So you might literally have one or two individuals organizing an entire sphere of activity if they had more of a computer science degree, and you might have, or background, or you might have, you know, 10, 12 people involved in a more committee-like structure when you had people who were organizing from a more traditional social movements background.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. Our guest today is Jennifer Earle, who is a professor of sociology at the University of Arizona. She is the co-author with Katrina Kimport of the book we're discussing today, Digitally Enable Social Change. We invite your calls and comments. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. As you began your research, you just shared your introduction in 2000 of strategic voting and how that piqued your interest in looking at how people organize. In your book, you are able to go in depth into this subject and into different theories of organizing. I was wondering perhaps if you could give our audience an explanation of two contrasting styles or theories that you talk about beginning in chapter two.
Sure, I'd love to. So one of the things that we're centrally interested in our book is about whether or not what you could think of as the engine or the fundamental dynamics of organizing and participation are changing in social movements. So as social movement scholars, over the last 30 to 40 years, we have compiled a great deal of knowledge about how people tend to organize and participate in social movements. And the fundamental question that our book poses is whether or not that stock of knowledge is directly applicable to online activism, or may need minor or, what we argue, significant alterations in order to be able to speak fully to a digital age. And so in the book, we compare really two dominant approaches to understanding this question of whether or not the engine is changing. The first approach, which is represented by, I would say, the majority of work in the field, although that's beginning to change, is what we refer to as the supersize approach. And that's sort of a playful note to McDonald's mm-hmm. supersize meals. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that the theory works the same way. It's just accelerated, expanded, enlarged in the same way that the food was the same. It was just a bigger serving size. And so if, for instance, we have thought classically that resources were really important to social movements, you would expect that resources would still be very important to social movements, but that you might just have to expand or enlarge your definition of resources to accommodate resources that might be more digitally focused. The alternative that we argue for and that exists in the literature is what we call a theory 2.0 approach, or what we could think of as a model change approach, where basically we're saying the engine driving or the dynamics behind protests themselves are changing. So the analogy I would give is a supersized model is talking about an engine going from a V4 to a V10. The fundamental engine itself works the same. It's just a much more powerful engine. The theory 2.0 approach that we advocate for in the book is really about going from a combustion engine to an electric engine. So really the fundamental dynamics of that engine work a bit differently in the digital age, and that's the fundamental argument we're making.
So can you give us a concrete example of how you've seen the actual metamorphosis of the engine in a recent protest or action? And we started out the show, Cecil was speaking of the Arab Spring protest, but is there another one that you would feel really helps illustrate your point of how the actual machinery and process and dynamics themselves have changed?
Sure. Well, let me give two examples because they perhaps help to illustrate different parts of the argument. One, I think, is something that probably most of your listeners have come across through email or while they're surfing the web or something, which is some kind of online form of what I refer to and others refer to as flash activism, mm-hmm. like petitions, email campaigns, boycotts, etc. And one of the changes that technology use has brought has been the ability to really engage a new model of power. So if the traditional model of power and movements has been that you get a lot of people to work really hard for a really long time, and then maybe you see some change, the flash model is really trying to draw a comparison to flash floods and say, maybe it isn't about how long the water is there, but how high and rushing the tide is while it is there that affects change. And so when you see a petition that's signed by, 100,000 people, 200,000 people, the idea is that there is this flash activism or flash flood model of power behind that activity, where it used to be that the only option we had for creating change was really this try to get as many people as you can to work really hard for a long time. And now there is this option to create change where you can get a lot of really large number of people, much larger than you could otherwise get, to do something for a short time, and it might still matter. And I'd be happy to talk about lots of different examples of that. Mm-hmm. A second thing that you could think about is more focused, which is whether or not resources are required before you can start an activist campaign. Mm-hmm. So I'll go all the way back to those first strategic voters that I studied in 2000. And one of the things that surprised Dr. Shishman and I the most when we were studying that was that the people who were organizing from this computer science background, they didn't want donations to support their cause. And people would offer them donations, and they would turn them down, and they'd say, look, bandwidth isn't that expensive. This is something I'm doing on my own free time anyway. Like, save your money, send it to a campaign or something instead. Mm. Now, you wouldn't expect to hear any advocacy organization ever say, keep your money. we don't need it. What we're doing isn't too expensive anyway. And so that change in the sort of startup costs for getting action off the ground, and also the change in sort of continual operating costs, has really allowed a lot of organizing to move outside of traditional organizations and into the hands of individuals, small teams, et cetera. One of my colleagues, Dave Karp, has called organizing outside of organizations. And so those are sort of two specific things you might notice, but I'd be happy to talk about an example of each of those if it would be helpful.
Well, I should hold on to that, because as you were speaking, I was wondering as of this new model or theory of organizing, and when you made your comment of, you know, we don't need any donations, you know, keep your money. I'm wondering your thoughts on how organizations who have traditionally used traditional means of organizing use this medium. So, for example, I get in my email box daily sign this online petition, mm-hmm. And you write in your name and your email address, and then pops up another box, you can donate now. And those are usually from like traditional political parties or labor organizations. Have traditional organizers been able to
kind of capture that?
To capture that but energy. Also to I guess to capture the energy of newer forms of organizing, but have they truly converted over?
Okay, sounds like, if I'm hearing you right, Susan, uh-huh. you're talking about, are they using the hybrid?
Okay,
are
yeah.
they using both this online way to support themselves and the traditional way? And because I've seen some fundraising, and we notice it ourselves here at the station, where some traditional forms seem to be waning and some seem to be on the rise. So like any savvy organization, we look to finding ways of capturing that online population. So is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay, does that make sense? In terms of what you've noticed?
Sure. So I would say that what people have found is that there are really two things going on with respect to organizations. One is the movement of both some organizers and lots of participants outside of organizations to this organizing outside of organizations. And secondly, to changes within organizations, what the same colleague Dave Karp would call organizing through different organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And the central claim of that work is that in this digital environment, social movement organizations, traditional advocacy organizations, NGOs of all types are really pressured, actually primarily for funding reasons, to try to think about how they can keep up with what's changing and these new models. So Dave Karp has a book on the move-on effect, and his argument is really about how move-on as a progressive organization that's across causes has been able to do a better job of fundraising than single issue groups have been able to, because it can focus on what's hot that day, whereas single issue groups are stuck with the single issue that they're focused on, which may or may not be resonating as powerfully on any given week as it is another.
So if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like this is kind of like a multiplier effect. It's not just that because of fundraising, there is this tendency to, I'll call it cross-pollinate for folks who maybe need a different type of metaphor, excuse me, but also joining forces not only revitalizes the single issue groups, but it creates a denser and stronger base, because you've got a synthesis, if you will. You've got a couple of different groups coming together and putting not only their resources into the pot, but joining forces ideology in terms of their ideologies or their political beliefs. Is that correct?
Well, Well, that's not quite Dr. Karp's argument. So his argument is really, but there is someone that I can talk about who sort of does make the argument that you're making. So Dr. Karp's argument is really that traditional organizations are sort of suffering in this new climate because they are struggling to adapt in the face of groups like MoveOn, who are able to outcompete them in fundraising. And so his argument is that these traditional organizations are being forced to develop new routines and try to catch up, if you will, and that that's causing a radical, so his book title is The MoveOn Effect, and the idea behind that is that there is this effect of having this really strong competitor in your field that makes everyone else have to change their game in order to accommodate that. Now, other people have looked at these kinds of synergies or cross-pollination that you just mentioned. So Professor Lance Bennett, who's actually near your neck of the woods at University of Washington, has done some research on how it is that the Internet can be used to allow different groups with, let's say, some surface-level ideological compatibilities to work together for a short time very productively to get at exactly what you were talking about, do a better job of mobilizing people together than they each could do individually on their own. And he refers to these as ideologically thin coalitions because he says, you know, there are some real differences between these organizations, but because people can cooperate for a short period of time and then move on to other coalitions where they're cooperating on a new thing for a short period of time, organizations can kind of get the best of both worlds. They can get the benefit of working together and the benefit of those synergies or cross-pollination, but they can also avoid the kind of ideological battles that may have faced organizations that were trying to make longer-term coalition partners and so really had to deal with some of those fundamental differences.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. Our guest is Jennifer Earle, co-author of Digitally Enabled Social Change. And we're discussing how the Internet affects social change and political protest. Do you use the web? How do you use it? Does it empower you or do you find it a hindrance? Give us a call and share your thoughts. Our numbers are 503-231-8187.
In terms of some of the examples from Dr. Karp's book and from what you're doing, what would you see as a way that a traditionally, I don't want to say tradition bound, but I guess I will say tradition bound organization can take advantage of what you see as new dynamic changes coming on? What are some of the things they would need to do? Because one of the things I heard you say earlier was that when the computer groups, the computer savvy, the computer engineers started putting together these networks to make change, it was a low-cost entry into the field. It seems to me that the market has kind of changed, and so maybe it's not as inexpensive as it used to be. So for those who might have been caught flat-footed and not been far-sighted enough to see or take advantage of this change, how would they take advantage now, or rather, how would they enter into that market now?
Well, I think if I were to make a pitch for sort of a radical new way for advocacy organizations to think about the Internet, my pitch would be that they should think about that new model of power as being something that in and of itself may be able to accomplish some of their goals. And so right now, a lot of the way that advocacy organizations use the web is really sort of thinking about the web as being the bottom rung of a ladder of engagement. So if we imagine a ladder and there are some really top rungs to it that are high up, that are really long, you know, sort of difficult, trying, arduous, expensive ways of participating, and then you have these low rungs that are, you know, signing a petition, one of the dominant ways that advocacy organizations think about internet use right now is how do we get someone onto the bottom rung of that ladder and then use engagement through our website to get them to climb that ladder. I also sometimes refer to this sort of jokingly as the gateway theory, Internet activism is the gateway drug of advocacy, much as people have argued about marijuana. So you get somebody on this really, drug that's not too hard for them to get a hold of or enjoy, and then they say, oh, I like this and I want more of it, and then they go to harder core forms of activism. And my pitch, my sort of radical pitch to advocacy organizations would be to consider that one of the most fundamental things that we know as social movement scholars is that you can get more people to do an easy thing than you can get people to do a hard thing.
Yes.
And so if they were to think about, okay, a ladder of engagement is a fine thing to try to do, and it's going to work for some people. But for the people who they're never going to climb that ladder, no matter what you do or what investments you make, but they are interested in your issue, are there ways that you could use your site to think about flash activism, that flash flood model, to get those people actually involved in contributing to your campaign? So let me give you an example of a campaign that was really successful. So there were two people who got together and said, look, there's a huge problem with sexual assault on campuses. And as we know from seeing the news about sexual assault on campuses, unfortunately, athletic team members are often involved in those allegations. And so the idea that these two individuals had was, what if we could get coaches to think about it as part of their responsibility to really educate their players about sexual assault and sexual conduct, and think about one of their jobs? You know, coaches, hopefully good coaches, are not just, you know, calling plays. They're helping people make moral development and, you know, become better young men and young women. What if they saw part of their job as contributing to safer sexual politics? And so these two individuals created a petition on change.org. It got a really large number of signatures. And out of that, a major national coaching association agreed to work with this feminist advocacy organization that one of the two organizers was a part of to come up with standards and training for their coaches. Now, you know, if you're concerned about sexual assault, that's actually a huge win, right?
Yes.
To imagine that nationwide in a couple years, a major national coaching association may put out educational tools and guidelines that were helped to be developed by a feminist organization, right? That's a major win. And that happened as a result of that kind of flash flood of activism. Because, you know, this coaches association, it hadn't gotten 80,000 eyeballs on it from outside of coaching, maybe ever.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was very strongly brought to the table by that level of attention. Mm-hmm. And so if I had a sort of, you know, radical agenda for how advocacy organizations could think about the internet, it would be to say, okay, this ladder of engagement idea that you have, that's going to be workable for some members, and it's certainly important to your fundraising model. But in terms of actually pushing for change, actually getting real change in the lives of the people you serve, you will be best served by coupling that with really thinking about how can you use those flash flood forms of activism to get very specific targeted changes that are still going to matter greatly to your members.
I appreciated your comment and that example, because I think it highlights the role that the web can and is playing, but also you affirm or assert that we should not leave it there, that this flash model is not the end all and be all. And what I've heard sometimes are some people who are critical of internet organizing because they believe that it isn't something that endures, that it there isn't the level of commitment that people have when they come face to face and they have that sort of interchange, and when they gather together to strategize together.
Well, I think that, gosh, there's a lot in that question. It's a really great question. I think one thing to think about is just, are those assumptions about sort of the stickiness or the relationship building capacities of the internet accurate? And I would say that now almost two decades of research on the formation and maintenance of relationships online suggests that the internet can be a very fertile and powerful place for that. Mm-hmm. So let me give you a real counterexample to what people are imagining. Jessica Beyer, who's also at the University of Washington, has done a study of a group called Anonymous. And Anonymous is as you can imagine from their name, an anonymous group online where people largely participate through chat rooms, et cetera. And they've been associated with some very radical actions online that are very high risk. So they have been involved in a number of distributed denial of service actions. And those are actions that you've probably seen or heard about in newspapers or on the television news or on the radio that are really trying to take down whole websites.
Yes.
So, for instance, when WikiLeaks started to really be pressured by PayPal and Visa not taking donations for them, this group Anonymous said, hey, that isn't a good thing. They were trying to raise transparency, and that's something that Anonymous supports. And so they did a distributed denial of service on several companies like Visa, MasterCard, Bank of America, and basically tried to slow those sites or shut those sites down. Now, those are very, from a legal perspective, can be very dangerous forms of activity. You could get arrested and sentenced to some serious jail time for that, and indeed some Anonymous members have been. So you would think that that's a sort of classic example of the kind of activism that people would say should not be able to be born online, mm-hmm. because that level of risk should require lots of face-to-face trust, knowledge, etc. Actually, what Beyer argues is that really this radically anonymous environment online was very facilitating for this kind of action, and that when she looked at spaces online where people did have what is sort of more similar to face-to-face relationships, and that they have name-based relationships where people have reputations that they try to protect over time, and so you're sort of known as an individual to your community, that exactly those kinds of communities didn't tend to spur protests online. And so I would say the first thing to think about is sort of maybe some of those assumptions that we sort of have in the back of our mind aren't exactly right about how much the internet can do to facilitate relationships. The second thing I would say about it, though, is that what I'm really arguing for is that people think about there being multiple models available, and that the question we should be asking, the question that's not very helpful to ask, is which one's the best, as if that is true for every situation in all time. But then a much more helpful question for activists and organizations to ask is, for this particular issue, goal, cause that we're trying to work on, what ways could we mobilize people? And so I would say, for instance, if you have a private target, as the Coaches Association was, or if you're targeting a company, online activism is actually a pretty good way to go after them, because they're very protective of their reputation. Mm-hmm. And online reputation management is extremely important to corporations and advocacy organizations.
Yeah, yes, it is. They spend a lot of money trying to weed out what they consider to be dangerous or harmful or erroneous statements online. So,
exactly. So if you go after somebody, an organization or a group online that's really invested in protecting that online reputation, you are going to be more likely to see results than not. I would say that, you know, would I, though, on the other hand, say, oh, we can entirely end racism through online petitions? Absolutely not, right? Although, you know, I would also point out we're struggling to entirely end racism even with offline activism. There are some things that are going to require us throwing everything we have at them to deal with them. And so I think the question that savvy activists should be asking is, how can I use these different models in different situations to forward my goals? So maybe I do need some people who are in that enduring, long-term, really committed mind frame, and they are working with me on these really high-risk, high-cost kinds of activities. But maybe there are other things, like we want to pressure a company to say that they won't go to Phoenix if when the Super Bowl is there, if Phoenix, if the Arizona government passes laws that are, strongly against gays and lesbians, mm-hmm. As happened this past year. So, mm-hmm. If you can think about how could you target different kinds of goals to different kinds of strategies, I think you would be better off than if you just say, we're going to go whole hog in on just one kind of making change.
Mm. You're listening to Jennifer Earle, the co-author of Digitally Enable Social Change. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. As you shared those very informative thoughts, I'm wondering if you could respond to this. I'm enabled to organize a group of like-minded people to push for this social change. It has been said that the internet has created bubbles,
or silos.
Mm-hmm. So I write, I engage with people who are like me, who thinks like me, and that very seldom do I interact with those who think very differently. Now, this may not be anything new, because we are humans and we tend to socialize with people who are like us. But it has been argued that it has become more difficult to interact with those who are totally opposite. So is it possible, using this technology in terms of social change, not only to persuade a company to change its policy, but to engage in with anti-LGBT activists in a way that persuade them to change their thinking?
In other words, how do you avoid groupthink and get some fresh controversy in so that you can stay dynamic?
That's a great set of questions. I would say that the research on this point is pretty interesting. It suggests that there is certainly a capacity for people online to, create what's been talked about in the literature as the Daily Me. The idea of a website that's just about what you're already interested in, so you don't get exposed to new ideas or things that are discordant with your beliefs. But that capacity also exists, as you pointed out, Cecil, offline. So, think about, when you have relatives over who have different political beliefs, oftentimes, even though you're socializing with them, people try to stay off those hot-button issues where there's a great deal of disagreement so that Thanksgiving dinner can be a little bit better. There is a sort of an ability to tailor the information you consume online, although there is a matching ability to tailor the social networks you have offline, and those we know from decades of research on social relationships on and offline, our offline relationships are also very tailored. I would say what's very interesting about the web that people often don't think about is there is a great deal of opportunity for what's called byproduct learning. So you're on a site, and you're on the site for reason A, but you actually, while on that site, come across information about an activist cause. And it turns out that if we think about deliberative conversations, so conversations where people are having to encounter viewpoints, as you were describing, Cecil, that are contrary to their own, one of the places that people report having those conversations across boundaries the most online are through hobby conversations. Mm. So you're on a hobbyist board. You really love model airplanes. And someone posts something about drones, and then there's a big discussion across a wide spectrum of ideological beliefs about drones. And that actually other kinds of websites, like religious websites or politically oriented websites and discussion forums, people are in those forums, you're only going to go to a forum that you, or I shouldn't say only, but you're most likely to go to a forum that you already agree with, much like, you know, I'm not going to attend an organizing meeting of a group opposed to my values offline. I'm also probably not likely to attend a discussion forum online for a group that's opposed to my beliefs. But there are lots of places where I might stumble upon or have that byproduct learning online where I get to see other people's positions. And some of them are actually in these really surprising spaces like hobby forums.
You know, that's the second time we've interviewed someone, and that very scenario has come up, and it kind of leads into kind of a related but also slightly tangential question I had. And so I'm going to kind of make you do a quantum leap here. One of the things that I'm really interested in is how the dynamic that was illustrated by Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone, where he talks about the collapse and revival of American community and how there is a diminishing number of people who are interested in being involved in what he called a traditional form of getting together. I'm wondering, do you find that those places like the hobby groups that and forums that people create online are one of the new ways in which people are engaging and creating a marketplace? Because if you look at the vitriol that you find in comment sections after articles, you don't really hear or see, I should say, any intelligent dialogue. But when you go to the hobby forums, that seems to be where people are more willing to engage and to be honest and to show more of self and be more receptive. And so it's almost like an electronic grange, if you will.
I think that's a great question. And one way to address this is to simply say, yes, for sure. There are lots of ways that the internet is allowing new forms of engagement. And I'll just talk to you briefly about a project that I've become involved in over the last year and a half, which is the MacArthur Research Network on Youth and Participatory Politics. And that research network is very concerned with these kinds of Putnam-esque questions, and it's basically asking, what are ways in which digital technologies may be able to be used to increase the level of youth engagement? And because of the sort of Putnam-esque concerns, I think people are most concerned about what's happening for younger cohorts, because there has been a tendency to think about those younger cohorts as being even less involved than older cohorts. So to the extent that you're making a Putnam-style argument, you would be really concerned about youth in particular. And the findings across that research network are that interest-driven ways of getting into politics online can be very powerful hooks. So, for instance, one of my colleagues in that network, Dr. Henry Jenkins, studies these kinds of interest-driven ways into activism. So, for instance, one of the groups he studied is the Harry Potter Alliance. And the idea behind the Harry Potter Alliance is there is this Harry Potter world that has very specific beliefs and values that are pretty progressive. And for fans of Harry Potter who really are captivated by that world and inspired by that world, the Alliance asks them, in what ways could you help make your world more like that? What positive steps could you take in your own life, collectively and individually, to make your world more like what you admire about the world that Harry Potter lives in? And so the Harry Potter Alliance has done some really fascinating and important social justice work, but through a route that people wouldn't expect, which is fan engagement. And I would say, in work of my own, looking at survey data on what brings youth to the table, what predicts their engagement in online or offline forms of activism, you can find support for that kind of argument more broadly, which is it is knowledge and interest in a particular topic that is really driving that youth engagement. And to the extent that the web is a place that can help to spread and facilitate that, we're finding within the network that the web is a very important tool to be used to leverage engagement.
And so another short part to that would be people don't need to be present with each other to make profound or lasting change. They just need to have a forum where they can touch electronically.
Right. So Katrina Kimport and I talk about this in our book as acting together without being together.
Mm-hmm.
So that one of the real core advantages that the web offers people is the ability for someone in Omaha to collaborate with someone in Tallahassee, to collaborate with someone in South Korea on an issue that they really care about in a way that would be relatively impossible for those three individuals to collaborate without the possibilities of the web. And so you're exactly right. This acting together without being together is a critical capacity that the web offers.
Go ahead.
I lost my thought just then.
Well, okay. I've noticed we haven't got any calls, and we're hoping that we're not scaring people away by having an academic conversation about the possibilities of enhancing civic engagement digitally. But I have another question, and this will be, I guess, what you call the devil's advocate question. One of the concerns that we have right now is not only net neutrality, but making sure that the net will not be interrupted. As someone who has studied this, and I know this might be a little bit out of your area, but how can we ensure the connectivity that we enjoy and we need for these wide-ranging coalitions? How do we protect both the access of the net and the similar technologies, and then protecting the ease of access, if that makes sense? In other words, that we can get on and that it's not metered or controlled and monitored.
Oh. This is a really important issue, and luckily there are people doing some really great work on this. There is a very large project that has studied online censorship across the globe, probably approaching a decade. And they do a really great technical job of tracking how exactly access to the web is controlled or constrained. And I have been with a graduate student, Heidi Reynolds-Stenson, working on an analysis of the extent to which countries' disposition towards offline repression influences how they engage in online censorship and repression. And from early results, although the work isn't published yet, it appears that there is a relationship where countries that are more repressive offline do have some repressive capacity, more repressive capacity online, although there are some interesting possible differences there as well. But I don't want to drill too far down in that. Instead, get back to the sort of more general question of well, what could we do about these dispositions? Well, one thing is certainly net neutrality. So what Katrina and I talk about in our book that has to do with low costs, that could be complete, that the potential brought by low costs could be completely undone by a pay-for-play system.
Yes.
And so net neutrality is certainly, in democratic contexts, a very critical issue, whereas I would say in less democratic contexts, probably censorship is, from the government itself, is a bigger issue. But I would like to raise one issue that I think people often don't think about, but that is quite important, which is a lot of this kind of flash activism gets started on private websites. So Facebook we think of as, you know, this public resource, but it's a private company.
Mm-hmm.
And it has its own policies about what can and cannot appear on Facebook.
Right.
That poses a real problem for activists, because there are times at which companies like Facebook have taken down activist content that other users found objectionable. That creates a real problem, and let me make an analogy to how that problem happens offline. So offline, there's been some work by John McCarthy and Clark MacPhail that has argued that offline protest is facing a real dilemma, because the kinds of places that have been traditionally protected according to the law for protesters to congregate, like sidewalks, public buildings, et cetera, that people aren't, large audiences aren't at those places anymore. They're at your mall, they're at your sports stadium, they're in all of these private places. Dr. McCarthy and Dr. MacPhail argue that essentially offline movements are having to choose between audience size and legal protection. They can go and protest where they're legally protected but have a much smaller audience, or they can go to places where they have no legal protection, private places, and have a much larger but short audience before they get arrested. I would say that, and I've written a paper on this, that exactly the same problem is happening online, where people are having to choose between, do I make my own website, which is the only equivalent of having a legally protected space online, but that my own website might have quite a small audience, or do I go to one of these privately held websites like Facebook, where there's a huge potential audience there, but they get to control what can and cannot appear on their site.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that issue of private as opposed to public censorship is a really important one in Western democratic nations that isn't getting enough attention right now.
Well, Professor, we're coming to a close, and we had callers who called at the last minute.
At the last minute, unfortunately. We have one, though, who's been patient. So, Mike, you're on.
Okay, thanks. This has been a good discussion, and I've been in and out because I've been working, so I just hear it on the truck.
And you have about 45 seconds, Mike.
Okay, so the question is, when I understand the point that your guest is making, but when you have to do hard things, difficult things, instead of easy things, I've noticed how the digital organizing just can't hold it up. There needs to be some kind of structure underneath to allow people to do tough stuff. And I was involved in the anti-foreclosure stuff, where you're working with families fighting foreclosure. And at one point, you have to be there on the ground, and you have to have the means to do that. So that would be my point.
And briefly, can you say why you had to be on the ground?
You have 30 seconds. You have to help people organize the resistance of their home. You have to go out into the neighborhood and explain to neighbors why this one person is having all these funny people show up with signs.
Okay, great. That's perfect. Relationship building, that's what you're saying. Thank you so much, Mike. Sorry for the shortness. So thank you. Thank you so much for coming on and visiting with us. We had our guest Jennifer Earle, who is the co-author of Digitally Enabled Social Change. Thank you so much for the generous gift of your time. And we want to encourage people to check out her other writings. Her last name, Earle, E-A-R-L. and the book Digitally Enabled Social Change. Stay tuned, because KBOO is your digitally and analog enabled social change companion. We're with you all day long, and start strong here at 90.7 Portland.
They'll be mine, all mine, practicing 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center screening of The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T as part of the Cinema Under the Stars program on Thursday, August 7th at 7 p.m. The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T is a musical fantasy film with the story, screenplay, and lyrics written by Dr. Seuss. Before the film, the Grand Style Orchestra will be playing a set of improvisational free jazz music. Again, that's The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, part of the Top Down Cinema series of the Northwest Film Center, on August 7th on the roof of the Hotel Deluxe's parking structure at Southwest 15th and Yamhill. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM Portland, broadcasting at 90.7 and streaming at kboo.fm. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Joe Clement. The Old Mole Variety Hour is the show that takes its name from Karl Marx's term for the revolution, that worthy pioneer that grubs, burrows, digs, undermines, agitates. We focus not just on political critique, but also on the ways that ordinary folks can make a difference, working away underground, changing the terrain of everyday life from below. Today's show looks at changes in that landscape, both large and small, literal and figurative, and particularly at how media representations and misrepresentations might reflect or influence those changes, including the kind of